For the next presentation, we have three speakers. They are Chris Lassinac and David Rice of Audiovisual Preservation Solutions and Richard Wright of the BBC. And they will speak about migration of media-based born digital audiovisual content to files. And we begin, I think, with Chris. Is that correct?
Yeah. Hello. Good afternoon. Is everybody awake? Should we do I think we should do a wave across the everybody stand up and all right. So I'm Chris Lassinac, and I'm privileged to share the stage today with David Rice and Richard Wright. The three of us put this presentation together based on a shared concern and some deal of consternation regarding a preservation activity that many archives are addressing currently or will be in the near future, which is the title of the presentation, and that is the migration of media-based born digital audiovisual content to files. As the one introducing the topic, I'd like to contextualize the discussion by offering a principle-centered and holistic perspective. To start, I'd like to quote, it's one of my favorite quotes from Ray Edmondson's Audiovisual Archiving Philosophy and Principles, where he so wonderfully articulates the meaning of the word preservation when he writes, "Preservation is the totality of things necessary to ensure the permanent accessibility forever of an audiovisual document with maximum integrity." So it remains a constant challenge for those charged with preservation of moving image and sound content to interpret preservation principles and the totality of things necessary over the course of time and across an ever-changing technological landscape. Principles such as integrity, transparency, permanence remain, along with general practices such as migration and redundancy, but their interpretation and application transition along with the evolution of audiovisual objects from physical analog to file-based digital. The convergence of audiovisual technologies with information technologies is a factor that simultaneously simplifies and complicates things. The once clear lines of demarcation between the practices, technologies, and expertise of AV and IT are no longer so clear. And while this convergence brings many positive benefits related to economies of scale and scope, it also demands the necessary reconciliation and vetting of a broader set of distinct practices emerging from these two fields. This has caused some tension, which has been of note across institutional sectors and organizational types, including among professional standards-forming bodies, where AV and IT experts are working through the realization of convergence and its associated implications. A physical manifestation of this tension in the convergence is represented by formats which straddle the physical, analog, and file-based domains, or what we're calling here media-based born digital formats. Examples include digital audio tape, commonly referred to as DAT, or the DV family of videotapes such as DVCAM or mini-DV. Ultimately, preservation of content on these formats will necessitate the migration in the near future, and there are two things that are certain. One is that this path will lead to the file-based digital domain. The other is that choices made in the migration process will have major implications to the successful preservation of this content. It has been established that there are separate and distinct routes and considerations for traveling to the digital domain from physical media and within the digital domain as files. However, with media-based born digital content, the path is not always so apparent. The process of migration for these formats presents choices on whether to employ practices and protocols which borrow from traditional AV or those which borrow from IT. These are nuanced considerations requiring deeper exploration and interpretation of principles into practice. A poorly selected pathway can result in a loss of efficiency, opportunity, flexibility, image and sound quality, structure, semantics, metadata, and more. What these smaller losses can add up to is an overall loss of integrity and authenticity to the original forever. The range of possible scenarios within this format type calls for a strong understanding of and consideration for both AV and IT domains when developing and implementing a preservation plan. The presentations that follow will navigate the considerations and challenges involved in selecting and implementing a preservation pathway for the migration of media-based born digital content. And while these presentations present variable workflow options, what they share in common is the aim to recognize and apply expertise, best practices, and technologies from AV and IT to arrive at the most effective solutions grounded in preservation and archiving principles and ethics. With that, I thank you and would like to introduce Richard Wright, followed by David Rice, who will offer their experience, expertise, and insights into this important and timely topic. And excuse us for one moment as we do a quick computer changeover.
Okay. Right. Well, thank you very much, Chris. Dave and I have information on the computer to try to back up what we're saying. I'm going to keep my presentation very, very brief. As Chris said, we are in an era for audiovisual archives where we have a lot of stuff that is digital, but it's not digital in the sense that digital library people and IT people think of digital. It isn't sitting in files. It isn't sitting on mass storage. It's sitting, as Chris said, on things like RDATs, CDs, DVDs, mini discs. It might even be sitting on Betamax videotape as digitized audio. And all of that has to be dealt with just as much as, where are we?
We're into transition.
We're into transition, okay. All of that has to be migrated forward just as much as the digitization of analog is seen as something that has to be migrated forward for obsolescent media. There are three cases, and when this comes up, I'll show them to you. If you have something sitting on, is this a, I can see it.
Yeah, everybody just come up here and.
Wow, there. Very nice, thank you very much. Okay, so that's what I just said. Including all of those video D formats that up to D6 that are pretty much obsolete. So these are the three cases. You've got something that holds digital ones and zeros. It may be that you can't get at the bits. It may be that you can get at the bits, in which case you could save them. You could make a clone. Or it may be that you can get at the bits, but you don't want to make a clone for one or another potentially very good reason. And those are the three cases. And I'm really here because we did the third case for the BBC D3 preservation project. And if it weren't for that, other people might say, well, I can understand number one and I can understand number two, but number three needs a bit of explanation. I put a question mark after mini disc. Because as of September 2009, there is technology available from one particular deck and one particular set of software so that you could clone mini-disc if you so chose. And then the question is, what do you do with it? So if the bits are not available, you have to take what you can get, and that's what archives have known from the very beginning. You have to rely on the decoding in the playback hardware to get something, hopefully something uncompressed, that you can then save. So that's pretty straightforward. Case two. If the bits are available, the easiest thing to think of, and it may not be the best thing to think of, but the easiest thing to think of is, okay, you can make a clone, and you can do that on CD, DVD, as it says. Can you use the clone? 8-track is the coding for mini disc. Do you have 8-track players? Do you want to be dependent on 8-track players? Is the life expectancy of the encoding something that you want to live with, or do you want to anticipate having to go off of that encoding and into something else and do it now rather than later? And then there's workflow. Are you putting together or are you using a preservation workflow that doesn't work on the signal or the bits that are in that clone, that in fact needs something else like full audio rather than A-track, or full SDI video rather than the bits coming off something like a DV. And that's not an issue of principle. It's certainly not entirely an issue of principle. It's very much an issue of pragmatics. If you have equipment that has certain requirements and that equipment is vital to you, then that's an issue of pragmatics. Case three, you can get the bits, but you don't like them very much. And that's what's happened with the D3 project. For people that are not familiar with D3, it was Panasonic's first digital videotape format. It's PAL composite. It comes out as a kind of SDI, and I'm saying a kind of SDI because it's 8-bit composite SDI, and that's a format that's pretty much been forgotten that it even existed. We decided that we wanted to decode the PAL and get to a component format, and we wanted to do it now while we still could, because the interface to the D3 is hardware, and the interface and the PAL decoding that we use is hardware. So we can't just assume that those are going to go on forever and ever and ever. So we made the decoding of the PAL and the decoding of the D3 signal part of the workflow for the preservation. And so we could get the bits on the tape, but we decided to do further processing on those bits at this point rather than saving a clone and leaving that further processing for the indefinite future. So that's it, and I want to hand over to Dave, who will talk in much more detail about things of much more general applicability, in particular DV. Thank you.
So good afternoon. I'm David Rice. I'm going to talk. I think this conversation follows very well with what Richard said, and also with York's presentation before. This is part of the presentation I'm calling Barcode Scanners, Mini DV Decks, and the Migration of Digital Information from Analog Surfaces, or I probably should have said analog-ish surfaces. So in considering a couple migratory paths that archives often need to go through, there's certainly a lot of experience within our field on analog tape to analog tape migration, more and more so about analog tape to digital file, and then sort of coming out of the IT world is a lot of research on digital file to digital file migration. And there's certainly some different strategies that need to get applied to these migration processes in terms of quality control. In the case of using analog tapes as your source, whether you're going to another analog object or a digital object, the two copies are never, perfectly the same, although there are certainly perceived similarities, and we work to try to increase the amount of similarities between the source object and the resulting preservation copy. There isn't the same concept of exactness that you would have in the preservation of digital file to digital file, which you would see in the IT world with data backups, and you'd use tools like checksums and tools that show where two files might diverge as far as their copies. So I'm primarily looking in this presentation on a fourth category of digital tape to digital file, because this migration path sort of falls into in between the other categories. Often a digital tape is handled a lot like an analog tape in the workflows we apply to them. But on the other hand, we can't exactly use digital tapes in the same way we can use digital files. For instance, we can't create a checksum of data based on a tape as a stream. So I'm going to look at the barcode as an example of something similar to digital tape, where you have digital data stored on a very susceptible surface. So this is an example of the UPC barcode, which you might find on you know, paper or cardboard or a bag of chips or soda. So as you can see, like, the numbers are made of sort of binary data. It's either black or not. And they represent numbers, in this case a 12-digit string. So barcodes are used to identify products, to associate them to prices. It's very important that data from potentially a bag of chips is moved accurately into a digital system so it can be associated with a price. An error in reading a barcode can make some pretty substantial problems with point-of-sale systems. So one of the methods used to verify that the data was copied directly from the product into the computer that's reading it is this concept called parity data, or the check digit. So in the case of the barcode, the last number, the 2, is the check digit. It is not it's not actually a key part of the barcode, but it's sort of a backup of the other data. So let's do some math. At the top is the barcode value, the 12-digit string. If you take the odd numbers and add them together, and then you take the first 5 even numbers and add them together, and then multiply the odd numbers by 3 and add them to the sum of the even numbers, you get 58. And then the check digit is supposed to be however many digits, whatever number you have to add to that total to get to a multiple of 10. So in this case, the result is 2. So if you read the first 11 digits of the barcode, you can do that calculation to figure out what the 12th digit should be. So if you're reading a barcode, the calculation that has to occur should match the 12th digit. If it doesn't, then the barcode's wrong, and the data is prevented from passing through the system, and you'd have to scan the barcode again. So this concept is very... Sorry, it's so dark. So this concept is similar in the DV family of tapes and a lot of digital tapes. So in the DV family, this is pictures of DVCam, DVC Pro, and Mini DV. These are tapes that often find a lot of preservation priority. One reason for it is that they tend to be camera tapes rather than like tapes used for distribution. So as far as a format, it's often very likely that if you have a mini DV tape that the content will be unique rather than a dub. Additionally, these tapes are made to be cheap and small. They're not very stable for preservation. The tape content itself is about 7 microns thin. And additionally, this tape is at its end of its life now. The last plant that makes them in the United States is closing later this year. I think that might leave only one plant in Japan left that makes these tapes. And I also wanted to point out that mini DV is often associated with the data connectivity protocol called FireWire or iLink. The two products were released approximately the same time, so it's a cable that is very well suited for transferring data from tape into a computer-based environment for editing. In the case of DV, it's a very unique case in that the way DV is stored, it can be both read by hardware, such as decks, and software, such as media players. So we often see a lot of information on how the structure of like a film frame is comprised, but not so much about how digital codecs are built. This is an attempt to illustrate the order and the structure of DV frames. So you have a header at the top, a subcode region that includes your time code, a vox area that includes metadata such as camera settings, the recording date and time, potentially closed captioning, and then you have alternate areas of audio and video data. We have certainly a lot more data reserved for video. And then the red areas I point out are areas that are reserved for the reporting of errors during the transfer. When DV tapes are read from the deck, often the deck is acting both as the presenter of the media and also the restorer. So if the deck cannot read the surface of the tape, for instance, if it reads a block of video data and then it checks the parity data or check digit and figures out that the data is incorrect, rather than presenting that data, it will either use a dropout or error concealment, but it will report in the resulting stream whether it did so or not. So these red areas are sort of where the preservation notes of the deck get stored. And then to show a little bit more of the structure, this is an example of I took two DV frames, which are made of 1,350 blocks of data, and I gradually replaced from one frame to the other. So this is sort of the order in which the blocks are stored within the codec. Within the codec, they're sort of scrambled around the frame, so if you have damage on the tape, it affects a distributed area rather than a concentrated area. I'd let it finish, but it's obvious how it ends. So to give an example of what error concealment looks like, this is very dark again, sorry. But you can certainly see a lot of glitchiness in here. When the deck determines that it reads a particular block of video incorrectly, rather than show its incorrect data, which would show as like random noise, it will show information from typically the previous frame to cover the results. So typically this produces a fairly acceptable result in areas where there's not a lot of motion. But where there is motion, you can see some data, it doesn't move from one frame to another. Attached to every block, the 1,350 video blocks here, is the preservation note that says what the status is. So if I take all those blocks that are acting as error concealment and I remove them, you can see how much of the video data is actually being read by the deck. This sort of produces a more film-like experience, because the projector doesn't sort of fill in the scratches as it presents the frames, like the deck can do, because film doesn't have parity data in the same way. One thing I found interesting is in examining the frames, you can see, there's more of a film analogy because often the scratches or the damages to the tapes can be continuous from one frame across many, as a film scratch would be. Although with the case of DV, the concentration of data for a tiny surface area is much more concentrated, so a slight damage to the tape can affect a large part of the visual area. To speak about the handling of audio, when the deck realizes that it read some audio data and it checks the parity data and it determines that it read it incorrectly because of damage or deterioration, it doesn't have the same technique as with video to just substitute data from the previous frame. If it tried that with audio, the results would be not so good. So instead of presenting some garbage audio, instead it drops it out. So you can see this is from a tape of a lot of audio errors, and the audio just drops to zero intermittently throughout the file. So looking around, even though the SMPTE definitions for the DV codec and DV tape define how errors are reported in the resulting file-based DV stream, we find that there's pretty much no tools to read this data to present it to an archivist to evaluate the quality of the migration. There are a few hardware devices that will present it, so there's some decks that'll have like a little light that will turn on when it's finding a substantial amount of errors. But there didn't seem to be an easy means to get the data out. So last year, Audiovisual Preservation Solutions started a project to create some software that would read a DV file after being transferred from a DEC to report on the errors. So here you can see a couple of examples of screenshots. So like in the top window, there's a column called Video Error Concealment, and it shows for that frame, 17% of the frame is concealed. So you can use these numbers to sort of evaluate what kind of threshold you think you need to get to before you need to go back and look at the frames. The second report shows the same as the audio I showed you, where you can see substantial amounts of the audio are missing. We made the tool so that it can export a Final Cut XML document so that it can be opened in Final Cut Pro so that you can have the errors associated directly to the content that it depicts. Additionally, while developing this tool, we found that it would be a good opportunity to also add some reporting on temporal metadata. So on the left side, you can see that there are columns that depict the original time code from the source tape and the recording date and time of the original content. And it can also flag when there are discontinuities in that. For instance, if you're recording a DV tape and you stop the camera and then you restart it, there's a continuity gap in the recording date and time. So flagging that is good for identification of new shots. So now that we have this tool, I should add that it's an open source tool available for free on our website. We decided to perform some experiments. So this is a picture of Stefan Anabli, a student at the New York University Moving Image Archiving Program. So we started a project to create, digitize, and then intentionally damage and digitize again some tapes to see what kind of results we could find. So we shot 3 minutes of tape, and this is what it looks like when you unspool 3 minutes. It ends up being about, five meters. The total surface area of 3 minutes of DV tape is a little bit less than half of a piece of printing paper. So we had unspooled it after doing a nice clean capture of the content. And then all of our nightmares, we intentionally damaged the product through in many different ways. We scratched on the top edge, the middle, the bottom edge. We folded, increased it inward and outward and along it. At one point, we demagnetized the tape, crinkled it. We did each error on different lengths of the tape. And then we put it back together and digitized it. So we did our tests in two categories. We did software-based tests and hardware-based tests. So this is us starting the software tests. We put the tape back into the original camera that shot it and then digitized that DV stream into the same computer using different software to see what kind of results there were. Initially, we've tested 3 pieces of software, Live Capture Plus and Final Cut Pro, and a Linux application called DVGrab. And we looked at 4 points in evaluating how the software handled extremely damaged DV tape. We looked at the accuracy in moving the data from the tape to the file, workflow issues, automation, and also the concept of intention came up a lot. We found that with Final Cut, sort of the intention in capturing DV is to ask the user what they want the result to be. So it's like, do you want PAL or NTSC, or do you want 2-track or 4-track, or what? Our purpose is to get the data as accurately as possible. So with Final Cut Pro, we sort of had to evaluate those technical settings of the source tape, set them into Final Cut so that Final Cut would match the results. With Live Capture Plus and DVGrab, the intention of how the software is designed is more in line of just moving the data from the tape to the file. And so the default was to make an exact copy as it could, and then potentially we could use settings to deviate from that. So we found that issue of intention interesting between the pieces of software. Additionally, automation, DVGrab and Live Capture Plus provided much more automation as far as automatically rewinding the tape, doing its best to capture the full tape. Even with Live Capture Plus, we found that it had a setting where it would capture the tape, and then if it reached a point where the data stopped, it would fast-forward the tape further into the tape to look for further content down the line. So if you had a few minutes recorded at the beginning of the tape and a few at the end, it could identify it and capture it very quickly. So just to show an example of what the damage looks like, here's a clip where we have the original on the left and the damaged version on the right. You can see when the camera doesn't move, it's not too bad, but when it does move, it's horrible. So using data that we got out of DV Analyzer, and sorry, this doesn't look very better, we could chart how much damage is occurring. So these bars represent the percent of the frame that is concealed or wasn't read from tape across 7 different pieces of software. So using this data, we can sort of determine the difference between data that came from the transfer itself versus data that is an issue with the media, as Jorg was mentioning earlier. So we can see a lot of very similar shapes here, but occasionally there are some isolated instances where one copy is much worse than the other. From this, we couldn't really conclude a strong preference for one piece of software over the other based on the results, because the tape is often a finicky format that plays back from one pass to another with different ways. But the advantage of using this analysis of those codes inside the DV stream is that we can determine if we want to do another capture or not, or try to adjust our process to change the hardware or the software by having some numerical results. This is the same analysis, but for the audio error codes within the file. And then we did the same for a hardware test using these 6 decks. For each test, we used the same software. We chose to use DVGrab because of the benefits to automation and easier workflow. I wanted to point out these 2 decks. Those 2 decks in the middle are HVR 1500 A's. They're very high-end decks, and we We heard that one of them was used every day nonstop. It was like the production workhorse, and then the other deck was rarely used at all. So in the result, you can see the one file has about 50% errors for a huge amount of the file, and that was the deck that they were using all the time because it was so dirty and unmaintained. Whereas with the other decks, you can see a lot more variety in how the transfer did comparatively. So this really stressed the importance of you know deck maintenance and cleaning. So the worst pass was that the dirty HVR 1500A deck and the best copy qualitatively ended up being the clean version that was brand new and hardly used. I just wanted to give an example of what a head clog looks like. This is what was happening on the dirty deck. So, of the two heads, one isn't reading any data, so it's just continuously showing the last data it actually read. This is, very bad. So, we definitely want to try to identify when it happens, because typically you just run the tape again, you'd get something much better. So the results, software results are at the top. We just had a small range from 30% to 34% of the frames had errors, kind of a narrow range for audio. And then for video error concealment from 30 to 86%, a huge range of results, and many things just falling in the middle in different places. One of the results we found, if I go back here, I have a question mark next to the audio errors of the hardware deck, and that's because we found that some decks don't follow the SMPTE rules for reporting audio errors. At the top, you can see one of the clamshells. This is what it looks like when the deck has to output audio data, but it can't actually read what it says on the tape. So at the top, it just uses 8000, I think it's the negative full-scale sample. I don't know. Ask George Blood. But it's an audio sample that plays out silently so that you just hear a dropout when that error happens. That value is not allowed in the DV codec. So if you had that value naturally, you'd have to use the next one up. The lower examples are from the HVR 1500A deck, and it used just all kinds of samples. You can see the samples are all the same for the particular block, but it was unpredictable how it would report on that particular error. So we had two post questions after the test. One, just is FireWire the most accurate way to transfer the data? So we wanted to evaluate it against SDI. So we noted there are certainly a few differences between the way video travels over these signals. With FireWire is more made exactly for DV, so it handles all the data within it, the video, audio, timecode, camera settings, this error reporting data I mentioned, whereas SDI is primarily more traditional video signal, video, audio, timecode, and captioning. There are some differences in color space and the compression, so you have to transform the data in order to get it over SDI. But we found visually when we looked at the results of an SDI versus a FireWire transfer, they were pretty much visually identical. Except with the SDI one, we did not have the information within the resulting file to figure out exactly where the errors are. We could use some video or audio analysis to try to determine, but as mentioned earlier, that brings us to potentially a lot of false reporting, whereas in the FireWire example, it's sort of like a yes or no answer per block. The second finding we had was that even though we can identify one file as the best pass, if we go on a frame-by-frame level, it varies. So this is a chart representing seven passes of the same section of tape through two decks into the same software. And we can see that the first pass is primarily the best. The green recommends the green means that it's the best frame for that pass, whereas the red means it's the worst. So we can definitely identify which one is the worst, the fifth one. But then with the others, potentially, if we use the information within the DV stream, we could combine the best frames from multiple copies to make one better copy out of multiple worse copies. And this is allowed because of the existence of the timecode and the error correction in it. And that's it. Thanks.